And welcome back and good morning to everybody to another episode of the Mythgard Institute's Riddles in the Dark, brought to you by the Tolkien Professor and Middle Earth Network Radio and a variety of other hard-working, dedicated Tolkien fans and organizations. We are glad that we can be back recording and that we were able to get Corey on the line despite the chaos taking place on the East Coast. The wrath of the Valar and the Eagles of Manwë attempting to destroy the Northeast. But we're really happy that you're here, Corey, and that you're healthy and safe, and that your family's fine, and also that you can join us to talk about the Rings of Power. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Yes. No, it's been kind of exciting here, but it seems that the wave coming on inexorably was looking to consume New York City and not Delaware, as it turns out. So I was okay. It's been very interesting, but I've been lucky. We haven't lost power, so I've actually had business as usual. I had my Signum Academy class yesterday morning and my Mythgard Institute class last night, which I held in the, actually while the eye of the hurricane was passing over us. It was good. It was good. And then actually the funniest part of my day yesterday was I got a phone call. I did an interview with Radio New Zealand on Sunday night my time, Monday afternoon their time, to talk about The Hobbit. You know, they had heard one of the NPR interviews and wanted to talk Hobbit with me. So I had a lovely interview with Jim Mora, their afternoon host over there. But of course, it was after the hurricane had started. I had just driven down from New Hampshire, where I was with my family, and you know, the storm was beginning, and I was afraid I was going to lose power, but I didn't. And so anyway, I'm talking to New Zealand, and he was aware of the fact that the hurricane was going. He was asking me all these questions about the hurricane as it was starting and everything. And apparently, they were so taken with the fact that they were interviewing me in the middle of the hurricane that they called me back yesterday. And it was like a random call from Radio New Zealand again. I was like, "Hi, this is Radio New Zealand. We'd like to talk to you again." And I was like, "Oh, great. You know, a follow-up Hobbit interview. How much fun is that?" And they're like, "Actually, no, we just want to talk about the hurricane." So I appeared on this show late last night as a, like, you know, a correspondent from Delaware to Radio New Zealand reporting about conditions from the hurricane. It was really fun.
How was that?
It was great. It was great. I mean, I kind of wish that I had more dramatic stories to tell because I didn't.
It's raining.
Yeah, exactly. It's raining and the wind is blowing quite hard. But I mean, you know, there were moments when it was kind of impressive. But yeah, I just unfortunately, you know, I wasn't able to be like, "Yes, okay, tree was just ripped out of the ground and thrown at my house," and because it wasn't.
I ran out and caught it with my bare hands.
Exactly. You know, the usual stuff. So. Anyway, but that was the most fun that I had in my day yesterday. But anyhow, we are also joined this morning by Trish from Comparatively Quiet Texas. Hello, Trish. Oh, is she still here?
She is. I see her modifying the Google Docs, but she might not have her.
Here I am. I had myself on mute. I had myself uncharacteristically on mute.
Very good. Welcome, Trish.
I'm here with my Radagast household, enjoying the comparative quiet.
Are there spiders or tree roots punching holes in your ceiling?
Nothing. I'm doing a little acupressure on one of my dogs to foretell the future.
Excellent. Very good. Yeah. Okay.
So of course, listeners, I will, I'm sure, be interrupting Corey and Dave from time to time when I can't contain myself, but I will endeavor to allow them to speak.
That's right.
So they're used to it by now.
We're going to talk mostly about the Rings of Power today. This is a subject we have been close to many times, and we've sort of pushed it back and haven't gotten around to it yet. So we are now going to get around to it. And I say Rings of Power. What I want to be talking about today is, in particular, of course, the One Ring and its role in the film, which is, I think, much less speculative now than it was of old. But also I want to be talking about the Dwarf Ring, because that, I think, is sort of a more interesting interesting question still at this point. So we're going to kind of do a little review of the history of the dwarf rings of power and what role they could possibly be expected to play in this story based on what Tolkien wrote. And then we'll talk about how we think that that stuff might appear in the film, and that is what our riddle is going to be about today, actually. But first, we wanted to go over, you know, as we have been doing of late with all of the news that has been released, do some sort of current events review in the world of the Hobbit film, and to be sort of thinking about and talking over some of the new revelations that have come out lately.
Well, this stuff's good because it sort of sets a stage for some of the other discussions. It at least to the extent that we should take some of these things seriously, and I always want to add a grain of salt to that. But to the extent that we're going to take them seriously, as definitive, they really do clarify the picture on many things, particularly where the first film's ending, in my opinion.
Yeah. No, I think that is becoming depressingly clear. And I say depressingly because I still really do not like the out of the frying pan into the fire ending. Again, not because it's not. I mean, in some ways, of course, it's from a narrative standpoint, from a dramatic standpoint, a sensible place to end. But it leaves so much. I just I'm worried about that. I mean, the overall sense of the shape of the three films that we were getting, and this is especially Dave from that Empire article, right, that mm-hmm. we were talking about, the primary sense that we're getting of the shape there, and Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, is that we're going to get up through Out of the Frying Pan into the Fire as far as the Hobbit plot is concerned, and we'll get some, White Council strategizing, but no action yet. That is no advancing of the White Council towards Dol Guldur at all. Film two will feature the Battle of Dol Guldur and the rest of the trip to the Lonely Mountain. So we'll get Beorn, the spiders, the elves, and Lake Town.
Mm-hmm.
And then film three will get the Lonely Mountain, the Death of Smaug, and the Battle of Five Armies. Is that is
the impression that I have.
Yeah. Again, this is not like we're not like revealing truths here. We're sort of putting this together based upon things that have been referred to by other people who may or may not know entirely what they're talking about. So, all of this, as usual, with sort of a grain of salt. But that seems to be the general consensus.
The grain of salt. The main grain of salt I would add is that the Empire article, at least this is the one that's really shaping my thinking. Frequently make non-quote statements about this will be in this film, or this is likely to be here, or this probably got moved, and it's not always clear whether this is a confirmed fact from Peter Jackson or Philippa Boyens or Fran Walsh. It's not clear whether this is something they said, oh yeah, that's in film two, or whether this is the author of the article kind of making an assertion based on sort of, well, it's pretty clear that this is where it's going. Because the one thing I will say is there's a quote a statement toward the end by Peter Jackson, or I guess actually it's not a quote, but toward the end of the article, the author basically says that Peter Jackson refused to sort of directly comment on where the boundaries between the films would be, or to confirm for sure that, oh, it's ending here and this one's ending here. And so I think there's a lot of things. There's things that they kind of know won't be in the first film just by virtue of the fact that we know that the ending's been changed. So like, from things that they said, we know that the first film's probably not ending at the barrels, because I think it was Philippa Boyens says something like, well, in the original ending of the first film, which was at the barrels, blah, 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 blah. So we know it's probably moved from there, so that's probably not in it. But the rest of it, I think it's worthwhile sort of not getting too excited about it, given that they say Peter Jackson refused to confirm anything. So, but I think there are certain things we can be pretty sure about, especially the things that were actually in quotes from the filmmakers. So Trish, do you want to kind of lead us through the sort of more interesting points?
Yeah. I'm double muted
chicken.
here, so there we go.
There we
No,
go.
I think you got me. You got me back, yeah. I'm double muted, so it takes me a little while to get myself back again.
No worries.
Well, so on the Empire Mag article, the hold on here. Where am I at? I'm coming up. So I kind of really focused mainly on Film One stuff, Dave,
Mm-hmm.
that you found. Interestingly enough, Film One will have a prologue, and he said it. I think Jackson even kind of said that it's going to be somewhat similar, didn't he, to the Fellowship of the Ring prologue?
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
he kind of drew that parallel.
Yeah, he very much said that this first film, in a sense, will be very, very similar in structure to Fellowship of the Ring, in that there's a prologue, then there's a Shire sequence, then there's some activity between the Shire and Rivendell, then there's going underneath some mountains and being in danger, and then finally escaping at the end. And then finding respite toward the end of the film. So it actually is very similar in terms of structure, and it sounds like that's how they're intentionally structuring it that way too.
It kind of surprises me. I don't know. Maybe it shouldn't surprise me. Maybe I don't know enough about movies that he would make it so similar, at least in the beginning, to Fellowship of the Ring, you know, to have the prologue kind of the same way. I mean, do you guys think it's like, makes
well,
sense?
I mean, it's hard because on the one hand, you can say, just from a narrative point of view, both films need narrative supplement at the beginning. I mean, if the Fellowship of the Ring had just started with Gandalf showing up in the Shire and Frodo jumping onto the wagon, you know, how much in-dialogue exposition would have had to happen for anything to make sense? And similarly here, we have, again, a story that begins after a major historical event. In fact, the Hobbit events are even more directly tied in that, you know, we need to talk about the destruction of Erebor in order for, you know, Thorin and company's concern and their quest to make any sense at all. So, you know, in some ways, I can see an even greater need for a prologue in The Hobbit than for The Lord of the Rings. I'd be a little bit surprised if it's quite as sort of sweeping and historical. You know, some people have asked for, like, the Battle of Essen-Ulbasar in the beginning. And although it would be kind of cool, I wouldn't do it as a prologue kind of thing. It would be kind of cool to have an opening sequence. But you know, that isn't what I expect either. But I don't really expect to have an opening prologue which is like, and now the history of the dwarves. Where we go first there was Durin, and then, you know, we had a bunch of other things.
No, first there was Aule.
Yeah, they should go all the way back to Aule.
Exactly. No, because then they'd get sued. I'm sorry. No way. That is Silmarillion material.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
10-foot pole. But anyway, anyway, I mean, so basically, you know, the way that they did the prologue to the Fellowship of the Ring, you know, with, you know, Cate Blanchett giving the whole, like, first there were the Rings of Power, and then eventually this all this other stuff happened. You know, that kind of sweeping historical panorama, I wouldn't expect. But to give some kind of an explanation of the destruction of Erebor, that I would, that I think is going to be necessary one way or the other.
Well, and I think there's a couple things about that. One is, you know, they did actually build Dale. I mean, the original Dale. So in order for it to be destroyed. So yeah, I mean, we're going to see that at some point. The other thing is, whether it's in the prologue or whether it's in a flashback. Hello, from Thorin. I know we are going to see Thorin. We are going to see the quote unquote great battle between the dwarves and the goblins or the orcs, because Thorin, I mean, Armitage talks about that he placed Thorin as a younger man in the battle.
Which
and then,
seems
you know,
hard to believe that he could
be
younger.
That's so exciting.
Younger, I know.
Right, exactly. What is he going to be like, what, like,
infantile.
You know, in diapers? Like, you know, riding a little dwarf trike or something? I mean, like, seriously, he's going to have a pacifier? What are we going to see? A younger Thorin.
I know. I don't know. Does he have, like, one strand of gray hair right now? Maybe they just take that one strand of gray hair.
Yeah. Right, exactly. The before and after shots with the one strand of gray hair.
I know. I don't. Or maybe his hair is going to be shorter or something. Or he'll be beardless. I don't
right.
know.
Right.
So it...
But,
It seems likely that...
But yeah, so we are going to see something about that battle. I'm sorry, Dave.
Yeah, no, it's all right. It seems likely the prologue is most likely going to be Lonely Mountain focused. And given that they've said that
right.
Given
right.
that they've said we're going to get a glimpse of Smaug in the first film, most likely in a prologue, that all seems to point to a prologue showing the invasion of the Lonely Mountain by Smaug. So.
Yep.
And that's actually the next point. A brief appearance, quote unquote, brief appearance in film one, fully revealed in film two.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's one thing we've been banking on from the beginning mm-hmm. is the fact that we're not going to get Smaug, or at least not going to get the full reveal of Smaug in the first film. And that I would be very surprised to see him go back on, especially with the change to three films. What I would expect now is teaser, for Smaug, teaser in film one, reveal in film two, and then, the full treatment in film three. Because if the question, and we're getting a little bit premature here, but thinking about the overall structure that we were just talking about, if they're going to only get to the Lonely Mountain, if they're going to break after the Battle of Dol Guldur and after, I guess, Lake Town, we're not going to get much of Smaug in film two, of course. Nope. There's not going to be much room for it. It doesn't sound like, I mean, if that shape turns out to be true, then I guess conversations with Smaug would start, would be near the beginning of film three.
Yep.
So anyway,
it's going to be packed.
It sure is. And again, this is the reason why, I've been kind of rooting for ending after Out of the Frying Pan into the Fire, because it just seems to me that the proportion of the overall narrative of the story that is going to be covered in film one seems to me distressingly small. And what causes me distress about it is the fact that it leads me to fear that it's going to be too compressed in the other two films. They're going to end up just leaving out a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And the whole point was, and Dave, this is what, your point of, several months ago, the whole point of switching to three films was so that they didn't have to cut stuff out, so they didn't have to compress stuff.
Instead, what they're doing is just making room to add things that we don't particularly care about in the first film.
I mean, what have they made room for in the first film?
I think the sequence with the goblins under the mountains is going to be really elongated.
I agree with that.
I think it's going to be made way longer.
That's really starting to be the impression
that
I'm getting.
That seems very likely.
Yeah.
Especially with the way that it's featuring in all the trailers and everything. I mean, it's...
Yeah. And the Lego toys.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And by the way, I was recently, both when I was down in Nashville and when I was up in Boston, I was taken around on bookstore tours, and I was signing the stock of my books in various bookstores. And most of the bookstores had a Hobbit table, and at least half of the Hobbit tables had those toy figurines on them.
Oh,
really?
Geez.
So I got a good look.
Well, so you got up close and personal, huh? You really got to examine them.
Yeah, the Toriel one, the Toriel Legolas pack, and the goblins, and I saw the Thorin and the Great Goblin one, and yep. Oh, they're interesting.
So,
and actually, speaking of which, it's a slight deviation on the topic, but I'm watching Dave's little marker run around here, and Dave, were you going to say this?
Yeah,
what you've got
go
your
ahead.
Marker on right now.
This is just one of my favorite things from the episode.
Didn't Jackson actually said this? That
yes.
He patterned the Great Goblin on Kim Jong Il. I was stunned when I read that.
I have nothing to say about that.
I also
to say about that.
I particularly love the fact that the Empire author, I should probably find this person's name, refers to Kim Jong Il as the late unbeloved Dark Lord of North Korea.
That's right. Well, the other thing is, I mean, definitely not by stature. He certainly didn't pattern the Great Goblin that way, but no. I don't know. Very odd. No. Well, let's see now. So we were just talking. So it sounds like film one. I mean, we are definitely getting, I think, pretty much confirmation that we're going to be out of the frying pan of the fire. The one thing is that Bjorn seems, like Dave notes, Bjorn seems ambiguous. We're not, there hasn't really been. I mean, you know, we've seen clips of them being in Bjorn's house, which I'm assuming is going to be in film two, but we're not sure if Bjorn's going to show up in film one or not.
Yeah, I mean, I would suspect, I mean, given where they're going to end it, I would not at all be surprised just to meet Bjorn at the end. Maybe even...
In the form of a bear, right?
In the form of a bear, yeah, maybe to see a giant bear by the end of the first film.
Right.
But, I mean, it depends on where... Well, really, it kind of forces us to revisit one of our previous questions, which has been made moot by the... by the shift to three films, is how they're going to end. On what note are they going to end the first film? I mean, some ways, I actually find that a kind of an interesting question again. We all decided, there was almost unanimous voting for the ominous ending.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that most of us were picturing, when we were looking at the barrel ride being pretty much the end of the film, we were all, most of us, I think, picturing some kind of like ominous lookout towards the lonely mountain, maybe a little burst of flame or something to suggest the dragon.
Sounds like that's being pushed off to film two now.
Film two, yeah, that might actually be the ending of film two, which again,
I'm looking at the comments. I'm sorry, back to our talk about Thorin being young. Ed says they call him Thorin Acorn Shield.
Exactly. Kat wants to see a bearded toddler of Thorin. I think that would be good.
So, so you know what I think? I personally think it's still going to be ominous, but now the omen will be Mirkwood and the Necromancer.
Yeah, that could
be. See, now I think that this question is a great example of how you guys got it right, because you made that question such that even with this change, it still stands.
Right.
You know what I mean? You made it.
That's right. Yes.
You didn't tie it to specific events.
Yeah,
so that's good.
People's answers, perhaps, are.
Right. Might not be the same.
Yeah.
Because I do kind of wonder that now, especially if we're going to get the, you know, this protracted goblin and protracted and probably multi-part, you know, goblin action sequence chase scene that we seem to be getting bits of in the trailers. And we're going to end then with the wolves in the forest and the fire and the eagles. It seems quite likely that we would end that in like a more restful place rather than a more ominous place.
Right.
But I don't
know.
There's still the question of like the last shot and where is it going to end? And it still does seem most likely, I think, that it's going to be ominous. Yeah, as you say, Dave, maybe a shot of Dol Guldur or a shot of just of the forest. But I don't know. I'm less confident in that now than I was
Yeah,
before.
I am too.
I think it's going to be this big shot of a bear up on his hind legs roaring at them and then cut to credits.
Yeah, or like, you know, and some, you know, some snappy remark by one of the dwarves.
Yeah, right.
Well, it seems, I mean, let's remember back to the Fellowship of the Ring and how that ended, since Peter Jackson encouraged us to think of these films as structured similarly. That ended with Frodo and Sam looking over the wide sort of land that they have to travel to in order to get to Mordor and Mount Doom, and I can't recall off the top of my head now what exactly that plane is called, but it struck sort of a simultaneously hopeful note, you know, oh, I'm glad you're here with me, Sam, and you know, no place else I'd rather be, Mr. Frodo, but also somewhat ominous because you're looking and you're thinking, well, these guys don't stand a chance of making it.
Yes.
And I can't recall
the Emmon Wheel you're thinking.
Yeah, Emmon Wheel. Yeah, and I can't recall if we get any glimpses of the other hobbits or anything else. I think it really just focuses on Sam and Frodo because most of the action with the company there happens at the beginning of Two Towers. So it really is mostly Sam and Frodo. So.
Right. Right. Yeah. No. Exactly. I mean that shot. That shot over the Emmon Mule and the distant view of Mount Doom in the far distance is what was sort of primarily influencing me in thinking about the end of the first film before. But I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, it certainly is a kind of a standard. I mean, it seems like a very natural turn to take to have, you know, be like, well, they have finally escaped this like one long protracted danger, and now here's like a little glimpse at, you know, the challenge that faces them in the next film. I mean, that's that as I say, certainly seems like a sensible thing for them to do. Though for some reason, like the whole like ominous shot of Mirkwood thing isn't doing it for me.
You know, really?
Yeah.
But doesn't that seem? I mean, if they want to leave us with a cliffhanger that indicates what's in store for us in the next film, so that we want to come watch, that seems like the most logical thing, since that's where they're going, right? What about Dol Guldur?
That's maybe possible.
What about Ross Gobel?
Yeah. Spiders
on the roof,
climbing around on the outside,
talking psychically.
Exactly. Yeah, that whole business about the psychic talking of the spiders.
Yeah, that was another thing that showed up in this article.
Doesn't surprise me, because on the one hand, you know, as I've been saying all along, I mean, if I could not imagine the spiders in the film Hobbit talking like they do in the book, like that. But
is the only one who can understand them. That's kind of cheesy.
All right.
Well, the spiders. Yes. So are we transitioning to film two stuff?
Oh, sorry. We kind of jumped ahead.
No, I'm fine. I just wanted to run down briefly. So, as far as we know, it sounds like film one is really going to be some kind of prologue, most likely related to the Lonely Mountain, as opposed to the sort of more epic dwarf goblin history. Then Shire...
Actually, Owen McMahon gave us a quote about that. I'm interrupting you.
From Richard Armitage.
That's right.
I mean, just because they filmed that, and just because Richard Armitage says, you know, well, we filmed this, I think it's in there. These guys, that's a good point, because Ed Powell also mentioned Benedict Cumberbatch's quote about, well, I think Smaug's eye opens at the end. So one thing's very clear from this article. They have some quotes from Martin Freeman about sort of what they're filming, where stuff is going. The actors have no idea. They don't know. Martin Freeman made that incredibly clear. It was like, yeah, they're bringing me back to film some stuff. I don't know what it's for, where it's going. You know, I don't know what's going on with this three film thing. I'm just going to trust that they know what they're doing. So, you know, like, I don't think we should give too much stock to actors saying, well, here's where the first film's going to end. Particularly when the quotes are from the pre-three film decision. But even afterward, these guys aren't sitting in the cutting room. It sounds like the decision for restructuring the story was Peter, Fran, and Philippa sitting in a room. And even as Peter was busy directing, Fran and Philippa were up in the room rewriting and restructuring. The actors aren't part of that process, and they really don't know. So I'm everything that an actor says, other than something like what Martin Freeman says, which is I have no clue. That's the one comment that I believe.
Well, and they do often say, I mean, like the fact that Armitage is talking about shooting stuff for the battle with the goblins that serves as a kind of prologue, that could reflect nothing more than that he has the general sense that that battle happened historically previous to, not that it's actually being planned to be put into the first part of the film.
Right.
Because, yeah, as you say, he doesn't necessarily know the structure here. Yeah, as Ed points out, the actors have seen the scripts from the two-film version, but not any of the cuts. And so that's it. Yeah, even their script knowledge is outdated, essentially.
Yeah. So, but anyway, so there's a prologue, most likely Lonely Mountain-focused. Shire sequence, Trollshaws, Rivendell, Misty Mountains, which clearly includes from the TV spots giant stone giants.
Stone giants, absolutely.
Probably an extended Under the Mountain sequence. Hopefully that means an extended Riddles in the Dark sequence, Escape from the Mountains, Rescue by the Eagles, and then not quite sure what else there might be after that. As far as sort of some of the other main stuff, like the White Council stuff, it really sounds like the White Council stuff is getting pushed to film too. There, obviously, the White Council will probably meet in Rivendell, while the company is there. I'm guessing, since that's the only time they would all be in Rivendell during the timeline of the films.
And we've seen several shots with like Bilbo and Thorin in the background.
But what they
So, yeah.
mention about Radagast is Radagast, and the White Council will be introduced in film one, but that the talk about the Battle of Dol Guldur is indicates that that will be in film two. I'm starting to think that the scenes that have been hinted to us of Gandalf sneaking into Dol Guldur and stuff, possibly a prologue for film two now.
Possibly. I actually would still tend to think of that as like flashback in film one, rather than prologue in
Well,
film
it's where
two.
he gets the map and the key, right? So I would think
Exactly,
we'd
because
still
I
see
think we're
that
going to
with
get the
Ryan.
story of the map and the key. I think, and what's more, I think that it's necessary preliminary. It seems to me, anyway, from a narrative standpoint, to be necessary preliminary material to the entire White Council debate. I could see it coming up as a flashback prior to the debate or something, but I mean, if we don't get Gandalf saying, "Okay, it's totally Sauron in Dol Guldur," then where do the White Council's deliberations start? I mean, that's where it starts in every version that Tolkien wrote of this when he talked about the White Council stuff, and we have, a fair bit of material on this in Unfinished Tales, for instance. Gandalf's, movements to try to get the White Council to act. Are all premised upon the fact that he went to Dol Guldur and discovered that it really was Sauron, who is the necromancer. So that seems to me, and like the business from the CinemaCon showing of the with the tombs of the Nazgul and everything. I mean, I think that that material, it's got to. I mean, what else does the White Council have to talk about if none of that has happened? I mean, like. Seriously, I mean, conceivably, I guess we could just get them being. I feel uneasy. There seems to be like something wicked afoot in Middle Earth.
But don't worry,
Maybe we
don't
should.
worry, don't worry, viewers. We'll tell you about it next movie.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think that it's
Yeah, you're right.
Especially since in the later versions, by which I mean Quest of Erebor and from that time period onward, the primary drama of the White Council story, not that Tolkien ever wrote out the entirety of that story, but we do get bits of it and scenes from it in various other things. The main drama of that story is having established that it's Sauron and then them debating what to do, and Gandalf being the proactive one saying let's attack, let's try to mess up, let's figure try to guess what he's trying to do and mess it up, and Saruman saying no, let's wait. So I'm kind of assuming that's what the debate in Rivendell is going to be like, or at least it's going to be based on that, and therefore the information has to come first. So I am still definitely holding out for Thrain and the map, Gandalf's Dol Guldur reconnaissance happening somehow in film one, whether it happens at the beginning, whether it happens as a flashback, I still think, I mean, it seems likeliest to me. It's possible, but it seems likeliest to me that that'll happen then.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Well, and we know we you know with the key and the map being flogged so assiduously by Weta Workshop, you figure it's gonna have a
That's
couple of
right.
scenes besides the unexpected
Yeah, they
party.
got to show those on screen, otherwise people won't buy them.
Right.
Right, exactly. So, let's see, but
So,
there are other.
one
Oh, can
last
I?
film one thing. Just
Okay.
I want a brief comment from you, Corey, on this.
Okay.
So, I believe it is Philippa Boyens. Is it her? No, maybe it was Fran Walsh. I don't remember. It's one of them. I'll go look at page 9 while I'm bringing this up. Mentions the trolls and says that the troll scene is important because the presence of the trolls out and about is the first, yes, Philippa Boyens, is the first clue to Gandalf that something is amiss because these guys are cave trolls and cave trolls shouldn't be out wandering around. that I is that true? Are the are we meant to understand that these guys are the same kinds of, like, what I think she's getting at there is that these guys are of a same species as the trolls we've previously seen in the Fellowship of the Ring and the other films. And so those guys shouldn't be out wandering around functioning independently and speaking, which makes it weird. That's not how I understand when I read the book. No. I don't take it to think that these guys are exactly the same kinds of trolls. Like,
no, well, there are a couple things. First, is the fact that the films in general have tended to want to subcategorize the races of trolls and goblins much more precisely than Tolkien did. I mean, we do get a sense, for instance, of a, you know, sort of ethnic difference between the Misty Mountain goblins and the Mordor Uruks and the Uruk-hai of Saruman. I mean, you can see when the three of them are together in the march across Rohan, there are some differences between them. The film is much more assiduous in trying to separate those visually, which makes sense. But they introduce this idea of, you know, a radical difference among them, like they barely look like the same kind of creature. And they did a similar thing with trolls. And, you know, there's not really a clear sense that that's the case in the books. As far as the trolls in The Hobbit are concerned, let's see, let me... I am trying to find the okay, here it is. I found it. My quotation about this from the books, which is not from The Hobbit, but from The Fellowship of the Ring. In The Hobbit, when they meet the trolls, this is not like a portent of doom when they meet the trolls. I mean, it's like unfortunate. You don't want to meet trolls in the woods. But and the people of Rivendell are nervous about it because they don't usually come that far south. But the area above Rivendell is called the Ettenmoors, the Troll Fells, for a reason. And that's because trolls live there. So it's not weird at all. It's not that weird to find the trolls there. It's certainly not a portent that something evil is astir in Middle Earth. It's just that like these trolls have like moved further south than usual. The line that I'm thinking of, though, which I take as a direct nod back to The Hobbit from The Fellowship of the Ring, is at the beginning of chapter 2 in The Shadow of the Past, when we're being told that rumors of strange things were happening in the world outside that Frodo comes to hear, and there's this one reference that says orcs were multiplying again in the mountains, trolls were abroad, no longer dull-witted, but cunning and armed with dreadful weapons. No longer dull-witted, but cunning and armed with dreadful weapons, I take to be a direct reference back to The Hobbit. Trolls were abroad, but don't think about Tom, Bert, and Bill, because that's not what we're talking about.
These aren't the Cockney trolls.
Right. These are not your grandfather's or your crazy uncle's Cockney trolls. These are armed trolls with serious weapons and that are cunning and terrible. So again, that in The Fellowship of the Ring is in fact used explicitly as part of a like portent that evil is astir in Middle Earth. So it's not like they're taking this idea out of absolutely nowhere.
Right.
What kind of The part of Philippa Boyan's statement that I find disquieting is the business about Gandalf's first indication, like he's going to be clueless until then, seriously? Because if that's true, maybe we're not going to get the Dol Guldur reconnaissance until later. In which case, what are we going to be getting? What the heck are the White Hounds going to be talking about? I don't know.
No, this answer has been provided for us. Oh crap! Who said it? That's the problem with the questions. If you answer someone's question, their name disappears, and then you forget who asked it. But somebody proposed that perhaps the White Council was meeting to censure Radagast the Brown for his animal torture.
Sean Gunner would like that.
Sean Gunner would like that.
I just have this picture of Gandalf running into the White Council room going, there's trolls and then there are hills.
Yeah, you know, I just I don't know.
What's interesting about that comment from her though, I sort of, you know, I don't part of me wants to go the route of, in commenting on this, part of me wants to go the route of, and this is the lady who's supposed to be the Tolkien scholar of the bunch.
Right.
Which is a comment made in the Empire article. But you know what? I'm just going to leave it alone. I'm not even going to mention that. Oh, whoops.
thanks for your restraint there.
Yes. But actually, what's more interesting is this really gives us a glimpse into how they're thinking about the story. Like this comment in some ways is one of the most interesting comments in that it really gives us a notion of where they're going and how they're framing things and how they're thinking about the story. And she mentions storytelling and a puzzle, which I think, and mentions that the world has been at peace. So I think that, think this really gives us an idea about, going back to your comment about they really need to try and do some of the necromancer stuff in the first film to set it up. I and we've discussed this before, I think the necromancer story is really meant to be a mystery to be solved during the course of the films, as opposed to the book chronology. At this point, we already know. I mean, we know it's the necromancer, right. And Gandalf is doing this quest as sort of on his way to Mirkwood to go do the prearranged attack that has probably been planned for years now.
And in The Quest of Erebor, he emphasizes it's a meeting of the White Council that he's going to, which is not a prearranged date to attack Dol Guldur, you know, like, don't be late to the sacking of Dol Guldur, but rather a meeting where it's going to be decided whether or not they're going to do that, and Gandalf is worried that if he's not there, the White Council will do nothing, and so therefore he has to be there in order to get them to attack Dol Guldur.
Oh, okay, so I'm actually wrong then.
Well,
I was interpreting the books as I was thinking of the sort of the kind of typical Middle Earth timeline for making decisions like this, which it usually takes like years.
Decades or centuries.
I was thinking maybe they were doing the same kind of timeline compression.
Hey, it's a blink of an eye for an elf.
Yeah, right. I was thinking they were doing the same kind of timeline compression they did with Fellowship of the Ring, where rather than...
Information is there, though.
Yeah.
The timeline in the books, Gandalf discovers that the necromancer is Sauron, and at the same time, of course, gets the map and the key from Thrain 91 years exactly prior to the unexpected party. 91 years he's had that information, and for 91 years,
and as we said last night, he's stuck it in his pocket.
He's been and this actually, Tolkien addresses this in case anyone finds it far-fetched, like, what, seriously, Gandalf was carrying that map and key in his pocket for a century? And Pippin says in the Pippin comments on it, he brings it out into the open in The Quest of Erebor. Pippin says, you carried that map for 100 years? And Gandalf says, 91 actually. So anyway, so yes, he's been carrying around the map in his pocket for 91 years, and he's had this information, and the White Council, I don't know how often the White Council meets, like once every 50 years or whatever, but he's been trying to convince them to act on this since then. So they haven't decided to act yet. So now I agree it could be sort of a compression thing, but again, and we've been over this before, and I still don't understand when on earth is Gandalf's reconnaissance supposed to happen? After they separate? So like, you know, Gandalf goes, you know, meets with the White Council in Rivendell on the way, and they decide, hey, let's jolly well find out what the heck is going on. And Gandalf is like, cheerio, that sounds like a great idea. So he goes off with the dwarves and Bilbo, and they go through Misty Mountains and get chased around by goblins for an hour and a half, and then they emerge, and then eagles take them somewhere to an undisclosed location, and the film ends. And then at that point, so okay, then after this, we go to Beorn. Now Gandalf leaves the company. They go in through Mirkwood and have to take their jolly sweet time getting kidnapped by spiders in order to allow Gandalf to what? Go to Dol Guldur, discover that it's Sauron the Necromancer, come back to some other place, Lorien maybe, that would be more convenient, and say, hey guys, guess what? It's the Necromancer. And them to be like, hey, let's uncharacteristically act instantaneously upon this information and turn around and attack Dol Guldur, all still while we're captives of the Elven King, I guess, up in North Mirkwood. And then finally, and then like after that, Gandalf's like, now I've got to rush off to the Battle of Five Armies. I mean, that's a tight timetable, as they would say in England. And,
you didn't even take a breath.
Well, Gandalf's not going to have time to, that's for sure.
Well, you know what this is starting to look like? And for the record, this is one of the things I hate most about the Two Towers. This is starting to look like the Ent timeline, where Pippin and Merry meet up with Treebeard, and he's like, you know, oh, we're not going to do anything. And then then they meet together, and they decide, you know, then the Ents have a record short meeting to discuss this, decide to do nothing. He's like, here, I'll drop you off. And then he stumbles across Orthonk somehow. He's like, oh, look, there's Isengard. Whoa, what's going on there? Gets mad, calls the other Ents, who apparently were following along, just, you know.
Or
just
can teleport.
Right, yeah, can tell. Who just, you know, he's like, hey, that's terrible. Look what Saruman's doing. I should call the other guys and we should attack. And they materialize out of thin air and start attacking. I wonder if that's what's going to happen here. Gandalf's going to sneak in, figure out what's going on, say, oh my gosh, we really need to do something about this. I better call the White Council. Well, there they are. Great. Let's do it.
Yeah. And here, at least, they have a slight geographic excuse in that, again, Lorien is fairly close. So
yes,
if Elrond and Saruman come down to Lorien while Gandalf is, in which case, why the heck are they traveling together? They're going almost to the same place. Anyway, then you have to explain why they don't go through the Misty Mountains with them.
Yes, right.
Since they're all going to the same place. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, goodness knows we've seen before that in this kind of compression in the films, they are willing to do a certain amount of hand-waving to explain why things... I mean, like, to me, the biggest... I mean, you're absolutely right, and I agree with you. That moment with Treebeard is my number one least favorite part of the films from a narrative standpoint. I feel like it doesn't make much sense at all. The second thing is that... The hand waving I was just talking about, though, is the, like, how we get Gandalf to Orthanc in the Fellowship of the Ring thing, you know, where Gandalf is just like, I'm not going to really give any sufficient excuse for leaving you in the lurch right now when you're in deadly peril, and instead riding thousands of miles away in an opposite direction on the hope that perhaps Saruman might be able to help me in some unforeseen way. Like, that maybe if I go hundreds of miles away, I will be in a better position to help you than if I just stay with you. I mean, just the more you look at it, the less sense it makes. But, you know, I mean, it kind of works on film, so...
Well,
I could imagine that kind of transition,
Kelly Tapita has proposed a solution, Corey. The U catastrophe button.
The U catastrophe button. Oh, and by the way, I want to hi Kelly. This is Kelly, former student of mine and my children's former babysitter. Kelly. Yes, there could be a U catastrophe button. That would be useful.
Kind of like the easy button for what is it? Staples.
No, what it's more like is the actual U catastrophe button from Lord of the Rings,
right.
The War in the North.
War in the North.
Oh, the War in the North. Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Gandalf pulls out his Xbox 360 controller, hits a complicated button combination, and Elrond and Galadriel swoop in and destroy the target.
Yeah. Yep. I hope that doesn't happen. But anyway, I don't know. I mean, Chris does point out that, you know, Galadriel and Elrond were in the first film doing some kind of long-distance telepathy thing. I mean, we do have precedent. You know,
that might be an effect of the ring, by the way. You know, the elven rings. That's an interesting one for today.
Right, conceivably. Okay. So, you know, we could... It is at least plausible that Gandalf could send out some kind of telepathic call to the White Council. Not plausible that they could travel instantaneously, but whatever. You know, we'll sort of see about that. I mean, I guess fitting it into the narrative is for me the hard thing, and mm-hmm. I do really hope that. Well, we'll see. The one thing I want to make one perilous comment here, Dave, because I can't stop myself on your Philippa Boyens comment. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if the thing I'm about to say is further criticism or if it's a defense of her. We'll see how it comes out when I say it. But the one thing that I will say, I do not believe that Philippa Boyens, you know, you were sort of you were implying, admit it, Dave, you were implying that although she's supposed to be like this Tolkien, you know, this the Tolkien scholar among them, that she doesn't seem to know what she's talking about. And I would posit that it is not ignorance, but the thing that does at times kind of get to me a little bit when I'm hearing her talk, like in the commentaries and the documentaries and things in the Lord of the Rings films, is that she will, well, I would characterize it as skipping steps. Like, it is one thing to say, here's what the books say. Here's my interpretation of what the books say. Here is my adaptation, the adaptation choices that I made in going from book to interpretation to adaptation. Here are the choices that I made. She skips steps there.
Yeah, I completely agree, actually.
Talk as if the things that she is, like the choices that she has made, the way she, are there in the books.
Yes.
Like, you know, and what's more, she also sometimes has that sort of air of saying, like, and as is perfectly obvious, and anybody who knows the books even a little bit could tell you that this is a fact. And that's the one criticism that I would offer there.
Well, you know, and actually, I'll defend her even more. There's nothing to suggest when she's answering this question. She says, they shouldn't have been there. Boyens points out the sequence where Thorin's merry band encounter three crabby ogre types intent on at it. Blah 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 blah. Cave trolls have come down from the mountain. That shouldn't happen. That's one of the first warnings from Gandalf. There's nothing to indicate that she's saying this is how I read the book.
Right.
If this were a screenwriter talking about any other movie that's not a book adaptation, we wouldn't understand that person to be referring to some external source. We'd understand them to be referring to their own story or script. She's probably referring to her script and her story. Now,
right.
I don't know to what degree she has confused her story with the book. I don't know if she's keeping those things separate or not. That's not clear from here. But I should probably be charitable and assume that she's a smart enough person to not have them confused. But right. Yeah, there's no reason to think she's actually referring to the book here. She's probably referring to her story. And if that's the story she's chosen to tell, it's not unreasonable, and it seems perfectly consistent with what they're trying to get at.
Right. No, and I still, and you know, and perhaps again, this is sort of my own ignorance. It's how I would do it. Whenever I made statements like that, I would always want to preface it a little bit more clearly.
Yeah.
Because when you make a statement about Tolkien's story, you know, when you say, you know, something like in The Hobbit this happens, or, you know, like this is what I would always feel very self-conscious. If I were writing an adaptation, which after listening to this show for several months, most people would probably hope I never do. But if I were to be writing an adaptation of Tolkien's story, I would always want to hedge it about with that kind of clarification, to differentiate between the story that I was adapting and the story that I'm telling.
Although, again, in fairness to her, you might well make that, and then when you looked at your interview in Empire magazine, find that it's been removed.
Fair exactly, enough. That's what I was thinking. She may have done that, and the guy's like, I'm not going to include that in the article.
Yeah, splitting hairs, jeez.
Yeah.
No, true enough. Again, the only reason I comment on it is that I have her say that sort of thing in the documentaries.
Yes.
But it's fine. Like I said, I'm not gonna try to get too worried about it. We're almost like totally running out of time to talk about the Rings of Power.
I did want to
actually, Dave.
I don't know if
stay.
You noticed in the notes, Corey, but my 10 a.m. Pacific time thing has been canceled, so I don't have a hard stop anymore. I mean, we shouldn't go on forever, but
okay, we have.
I think we should. I think let's. Yeah,
let's just start a continuous podcast from now until
one of these days. We're just going to cut loose. You know, pretty soon as we get closer to the film, we're just going to be like, "All right, we're actually just not going to stop talking until the film comes out."
24/7.
Right. We're going to have like a sixth consecutive day podcast.
Well, let's
all riddles in the dark all the time. I do have a couple of points I want to make from another article.
Let's Trish,
let me do that.
Let's skate over the film 2 stuff.
I actually would like to make points from another article, from a different article.
Okay. Yeah. There's a few. Things
yeah, I don't. Re- yeah, let's yeah. let's skate over the film 2. There were some interesting points made in an article on Collider.com, mm-hmm. A Hobbit set, and I won't go through all of the ones I have listed here, but there is the one about that's pertinent to today, where he talks about the effects of the ring on Bilbo, and he says the effects of the ring will gradually build up over the course of the Hobbit movies. Jackson says, so the first time he puts it on, it's simply a magic ring, but each time he puts it on, the effect of it gets to him a bit more. Now hold on to that one, because we'll get to that when we're going to get to the shank of our show. The other ones I thought were kind of interesting is that Ian McKellen says a couple things. One is, this, I thought this was interesting. He says he doesn't make much of a connection between Gandalf the Grey and Gandalf the White, and that he never really warmed up to the White. He says the Grey is full of all sorts of life. And then he goes on to say that he thinks the script of The Hobbit makes Gandalf a bit less bossy than he is in the book. So that's interesting.
That's interesting.
And the other, last one is, the point gets made in this article that dwarf kingdoms are designed in a way that overcompensates for their short stature. So anyway, those are the three I kind of wanted to pull from that to highlight.
Yeah, but that is interesting. The bossy Gandalf is actually that I find kind of interesting, and I sort of wonder how that's going to come across on the film. That is, I mean, again, thinking about Dave's comments about actors before, you know, Ian McKellen could very well have in his mind less bossy. Will it necessarily come across in exactly that way in the film as it's going to be cut and presented? But you know, assuming it is, I find it interesting because Gandalf in The Quest of Erebor is much more bossy. I mean, the biggest change between Gandalf in the published Hobbit and Gandalf, the later Gandalf, especially the later Quest of Erebor Gandalf, the Gandalf in retrospect, when you change the situation, as the situation was changed with the writing of The Lord of the Rings, when now all of a sudden Gandalf is coming into this knowing that this is one small chapter in the overall story of Middle-earth, and like the main deal here is Sauron is taking shape and we've got to figure out some way to thwart him. Gandalf is worried that that Sauron is going to try to attack Lorien or Rivendell while they're still vulnerable and before they can defend themselves, and he's trying to figure... So, you know, for him, the whole Quest of Erebor is only ever a sideline, one way in which he might be able to thwart one of Sauron's plots, which would be to use the dragon to attack Rivendell. So, you know, so basically this, the Gandalf that we get in The Quest of Erebor is a Gandalf with the weight of the world on his shoulders who sees this whole thing, knows what's going to happen, very few other people see it yet or are mobilized to try to stop it yet, and him being like at the end of his rope. So, I mean, he's really chippy with Thorin. You know, when Thorin is being all haughty and looking down on Bilbo and everything, Gandalf is like at the end of his rope and, you know, trying to get him to do, you know, to fall into line and to help, since Gandalf is trying to help him anyway. So that's actually, to me, a very interesting shift, if they choose to make Gandalf sort of lighthearted in some way. And it makes me wonder. It makes me wonder, thinking about sort of Gandalf's character arc in this movie, because it's something we actually haven't talked about too much. But of course, Gandalf does have a very significant character arc in the Lord of the Rings films, as of course you have the, you know, the return of Gandalf the White and everything else. And I presume with three films involving Gandalf, and especially fairly centrally involving Gandalf in the White Council plot, in addition to his role in the quest and return in the Battle of Five Armies, I assume we're going to be getting some kind of distinct character arc for Gandalf. He's not just going to be a static figure, I presume, throughout all of that. And so, you know, I wonder how they're going to be doing that. And so maybe we will get, at the beginning, Gandalf starting off in ignorance and being kind of a happy-go-lucky guy and then sort of becoming more and more aware of what's going on and, you know, becoming more serious and I don't know if he gets bossier or not, but anyway, that does really sort of lead me to wonder about that.
Because isn't that part of the? I mean, that's sort of an element of the comedic tone of The Hobbit. Gandalf constantly talking down to the dwarves and Bilbo.
Yeah, I mean,
being this kind of caustic, grumpy old man. It's like, you know, I'm really getting tired of babysitting you guys and right. saving your butts.
Yeah, I mean the kind of he is kind of arch, you know, like when he comes back and saves them from the trolls, and they say, "Where were you?" And he says, "You know," he says, "Yeah." They say, where did you disappear to? And he says, I was looking ahead. And they say, well, what brought you back in the nick of time? Looking behind, he says.
Yes.
You know, there's
real smart ass.
Exactly.
well,
but in a fairly kind of condescending way.
This is kind of similar to comments you've made about the Lord of the Rings films, in that when you're reading Tolkien's writing, the characters we're meant to relate to, the characters who really have arcs, are the hobbits, and everybody else tend to be sort of mythic archetypal characters. And I think that's true here to an extent. You know, we relate to some of the dwarves, but Gandalf definitely not meant to be a relatable character here. Gandalf is sort of this, he's like you said, he's Archer, he's like a meta character, in that he's really sort of guiding Bilbo along in his character development, in his arc. And once again, what the filmmakers are doing is turning him into an actual human character. So he's not going to be the sort of bossy kind of commenting on Frodo or on Bilbo's journey, but rather actually participating in it. He's going to be scared and uncertain. We've seen the scenes with Galadriel and things like that. So
yeah, especially that kind of thing. I mean, that kind of, you know, Gandalf sort of looking, you know, almost but not quite at the camera, you know he gives me courage, you know, is exactly the kind of thing that Gandalf and the Hobbit never would have said, even though Gandalf and the Hobbit is certainly vulnerable. I mean, he is much more vulnerable than Gandalf in the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
I mean, in that he almost is killed by the wolves and goblins, and would have been killed had it not been for the eagles. So, anyway, yeah, it's... I do suspect that they are going to be doing that, and we'll see kind of how that ends up, how the whole revelation of the necromancer as Sauron kind of plays into that. Mm-hmm. But we probably should transition to...
I was just going to do that.
Wait.
I was just going to do that.
To the Rings.
Wait. A couple other things, though. Just some things to touch on. So film two stuff that is all but confirmed to be moved there. Toriel, Gandalf at Dol Guldur. And that brings up your question, Corey, of when will we get to see him sneaking in? The question I always have is that Gandalf at Dol Guldur thing, is that a flashback to an earlier sneak in, or is that him doing it contemporaneous with events of The Hobbit? Who knows? On our speaking animals thing, I think we actually nailed the spiders, because we said all along that we didn't think that we thought maybe the spiders would not be actually physically speaking, but might be an effect of the ring allowing Bilbo to understand them somehow. And that's Peter Jackson all but says that, says the spiders will essentially be kind of speaking psychically.
Yes. And can I say, actually, this strikes me as a very kind of typical thing. That is one of the things that I think we can see the filmmaking team doing at a couple points in The Lord of the Rings, is picking up on a really stray mention in Tolkien, often like something which... you know, like, for instance, the biggest example that I can think of is the arrival of the elves at Helm's Deep. Of course, Gimli and Legolas do have that conversation where Legolas is like, I wish I had a bunch of my kinsfolk here. You know, there are good archers among the Rohirrim, but boy, what I wouldn't give for a whole big, like, a battalion of elven archers to show up right now. And, of course, it doesn't happen, but that reference is there, right? And so, like, that reference of something which is not true and does not occur gets kind of taken up into the actual film story. And there is a similar moment when Sam first puts on the ring in the Pass of Cirith Ungol, and he hears Shagrat and Gorbag talking. Sam suspects that it's the power of the ring that gives him understanding of speech. Understanding of the speech of the creatures of the enemy, or perhaps just understanding. And I believe the implication is that that's actually not true, that it doesn't, in fact, do that. But Sam has that one brief thought where he says, oh, I wonder if the ring gives me comprehension of speech. And so the idea that they would kind of seize upon that and be like, yeah, hey, the ring gives him the power to understand speech.
So they only read that far and then stopped and went back to the script.
I'm not saying, you know, in saying that, I'm not saying that they're like
getting it wrong.
Being bad readers or getting it wrong.
No, rather they
rather
They said there's the kernel, the idea there, and yeah. maybe Tolkien, as we read the book, intend for us to not think that's true. Although I got to be honest, whenever I read that part, I assume that Sam's correct. But they're looking and saying that's a useful device for our purposes in
right.
making the film.
Right. And even like, you know, that was my reaction
Boy,
to
we've
the
really
elves
become
at Helm's Deep. You know, I was like,
I know, I was just thinking, boy, you guys have really gone wussed out.
No, but the thing is, I can see the point. I can see the point. Because, no, I mean, that was my first reaction when the elves showed up at Helm's Deep. I laughed. And I was like, hey, it's like a wish fulfillment dream, you know? I mean, like, this is what Legolas, like, wanted to happen. I mean, honestly, my reaction when I saw that, I was like, wait, where are the dwarves? Are the dwarves coming too? Like, is Gimli going to get his wish also? You know? Like, this is awesome. It was really funny. But anyway, yeah, no, so exactly, the concept is there. And so the sense that I have of them is that that rather than just if they have a choice, rather than making something up totally out of whole cloth and imposing it upon the story, they do tend to sort of mine any of these kinds of things that are there, even like, if the concept is raised, even if it's not executed. They tend to go there rather than simply making up something that's wholly alien to it. On the one hand, I can certainly appreciate that perspective if I'm right about that. On the other hand, sometimes it's a little bit silly, and I find it comical in ways in which it was presumably not intended to be comical. But you know, it's there it is. So Trish, I will be firm enough in saying that I do think that sometimes it's fairly silly. But yeah, I mean, my other favorite example of this, by the way, is like that, like hideous white elephant man orc guy who's leading the battle at Minas Tirith in The Return of the King. Which to me, I don't even know if they had this reference in mind, but it was all I could think of when I first saw that guy is the line that Tolkien gave, the intro line to the appearance of the Witch King, when the Witch King is coming back, when he leaves the gate where he's confronting Gandalf and comes and swoops in to attack Theoden. You know, Tolkien leads in with, but it was no brigand or orc chieftain who was leading the armies. It was the Witch King, right? And then as soon as I saw that guy giving commands in the film, I'm like, hey, look, it's a brigand, an orc chieftain who's leading the armies. Turns out it is, after all. And I just thought that was hilarious. But like I said, I don't know if they remembered that line at all when they were doing that, but I thought it was funny. So you know, like again, so this kind of thing, like to you know, for them to be like, hey, the O-ring gives understanding of languages. Like, well, I don't think it does, but okay, cool. Yeah. I could see that. So basically, that's why I would not be shocked to find that. And frankly, I think it's a good device. I mean, having the spiders somehow articulate English would just that would be too. I mean, it's a little bit discordant in the book. If you think about it, though, the sort of the style and the comedy of the book, it doesn't. I mean, it's not hard to get into it. On screen, it would look. I mean, having these huge and scary spiders saying what the spiders say in the book, which is that wouldn't work at all. So having him kind of understand them and have nobody else understand them, that all seems. I think that seems to be a really good compromise.
I agree.
But
I'm just glad I'm seeing this movie with you, Corey. You'll make me laugh. That's my most upsetting points.
Yeah. It certainly is. More and more I think about it, the more I think it was not only wise, but really charitable and generous of us to arrange to see The Hobbit film in a private screening, because most of us individually will be a public menace.
Yeah,
I know.
And they should be glad that they don't get people like us in the focus groups of the early screenings of these films. otherwise they'd be getting hacked to death. They'd be like, the audience is laughing at that scene.
That's right. That's right.
Not the reaction we were looking for at all.
Right, exactly.
God, it'd probably be like jury selection. You know, we'd get totally thrown out.
Yeah, it would be.
Tell us a little bit about what podcast you listen to. I'm an avid listener to Tolkien Professor. You're out.
He's out.
Yeah. Disqualified.
So we really should get on.
Are you guys ready to ship?
No, not just yet. Because there's actually some really big matters that I just want to touch on, and then we can either talk about them or we can skip over them. But so
okay, see, this is great. Dave has been parched for Tolkien stuff.
Yes.
So we need to let him.
Well, it's just some of these things. I just know these are things that the listeners would want us to comment on, and I know Corey wants to probably put in his two cents. Martin Freeman. And some of the other actors in the article mentioned that they're returning to shoot in May, I presume May 2013. So one interesting thing is Martin Freeman mentions that they might be shooting some bridging scenes, so some scenes for sort of bridging between films, presumably between the second and third film, since the first film will all be out by then. But more important, apparently, despite their super efficiency and the amount of time they had to film, apparently they didn't film very much of the Battle of Five Armies yet. And apparently there's a lot of Battle of Five Armies stuff. Like, on page 13, they're talking about this, and actually, maybe I should just find the quote. But there's two
actually, I've seen that elsewhere. Other people have said that, too.
Yeah, there's two.
Have said that they haven't.
There's, like, two huge things that they haven't filmed. Let's see. Here it is. So they're doing supplementary filming, but with resources, blah, 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 blah. The only thing anyone is sure of is that they really hadn't got to grips with the Battle of Five Armies before principal photography concluded in July. So that is bound to play a large role in the production to come. So they actually still have a lot of Battle of Five Armies to film, including, I'm pretty sure, Thorin's death scene. Because they asked Richard Armitage if he'd shot his most poignant scene yet, and he said, no, not yet, solemnly.
God, that's almost like all of movie 3, I would assume.
Yeah.
I mean, a big chunk of it anyway.
They haven't shot movie 3 yet, basically.
Well, the major thing, the other major thing that would be there is the Lake Town stuff and the death of Smaug. Mm-hmm. So, and no one's referring to that. So maybe they have shot that.
Yes.
In fact, I would expect that from those shots of Lake Town that leaked and then were shut down, the ones that included shots of the mayor of the master of Lake Town. I would assume that they've shot the death of Smaug, but it does sound like quite a lot of material there. Very interesting, and I wonder. My big question is: does this mean that their conception of that is going to evolve in any way? How is it going to be influenced? Yeah, I don't know.
Given the way their concept of the whole trilogy has evolved over the last 6 months, where to read the article, it sounds like they were in the middle of shooting and kind of just started saying like, let's do a thought experiment. Suppose we were to turn this into a trilogy. Boy, we really like that. We should go ask the producers if we can do that. It seems that they would be unable to resist the temptation over the next 6 months to start especially after the first film comes out, to say, boy, people really ate up these action scenes. Maybe we should add some more of that in for Battle of the Five Armies, yada, yada, yada.
Right, right. I mean, especially if they're not going to film it until after the first film is out.
Mm-hmm. And one last thing, Corey.
Well, it helps the role-playing game industry a lot if they do a lot of action.
One last thing, Corey. Did you see what they said they're going to do? Aerial battles between eagles and vampire bats.
Oh, right.
And vampire bats. I did see that. I did see that. I think that's kind of fun. That's a serious throwback, is what that is. Because the bats, of course, the bats are there in the published Hobbit. We get a cloud of bats flying over the goblin armies so thickly that they are obscuring the sun, and then you get a reference. The only references that stick, no pun intended, from the bats is that when they come in, they attach themselves vampire-like to the stricken, so they are like feeding on the wounded on the battlefield, which is modestly awful, but we don't get much of a sense of them having a very substantive impact on the battle. Mm-hmm. In the manuscript of it, which I was just discussing with my Mythgard class last week, there are more references to the bats in the first draft of the Battle of Five Armies scene in the manuscript. And it talks about them attacking the archers and stuff, so that basically the bats are deployed in the battle as primarily to try to neutralize the elven archers who are up on the slopes of the mountain and shooting down at the goblins in the valley, which makes a lot of sense. The idea that that the bats could take on the eagles in any sense is kind of interesting and would seem to suggest that we're talking about giant freaking bats here. And if that's the case, that's a serious throwback, because we do get giant bats in Tolkien, but we only get giant bats in really early versions. Thúrin Gwethil,
yes,
who's Thúrin Gwethil the vampire, which means disappointingly, Thúrin Gwethil the vampire bat, is the major messenger of Sauron in the early version of the Lay of Lathian material of the Beren and Lúthien stuff. It is Thúrin Gwethil's form that Lúthien takes when they go into to attack Morgoth, when she and Beren go into Thangorodrim. So there are giant vampire bats back in the day. I mean, predating The Hobbit, back in like the Book of Lost Tales time, the concept of giant evil bats is there in Tolkien's writing. Now, is Philippa Boyens reading the Book of Lost Tales and wanting to recover bats from there? Did they get around back to that in a more indirect way? Is that in fact what we're going to see, gigantic bats? I don't know. But that's interesting. I would not have guessed that.
And if they do use those from the Book of Lost Tales, they're certainly not going to be mentioning that to any media person.
No, they're certainly not. I think they'll
refer to Thúrin Gwethil by name.
No. Lawsuits.
Andy Higgins says Book of Lost Tales in the movie is his thesis subject.
Well, Good Book Lord, of Lost Andy. Tales is his thesis subject, so he would be delighted to see Book of Lost Tales.
He's in the movie.
Yeah.
Well, I hope, Andy, you don't talk too much about it in the movie. I mean, that could be trouble, right?
I will say in general, I don't know how they're going to do this, but on the whole, I find the idea fairly exciting.
I think that's pretty cool. I don't know. I mean, it has a chance to be awful, of course, but it is interesting. I mean, it is in several ways a kind of a logical expansion on the material that's there in the book, and there is precedent for it. Giant bats are indeed native to Tolkien's world, though they went extinct a long time ago. They went extinct back in the Book of Lost Tales and haven't been cited since. Tolkien dropped giant bats back in the 20s. I mean, I don't think... I'm trying to remember if in the Lay of Lathian, the epic poem of version of Beren and Lúthien that he was writing in the late 20s, early 30s, if there are still any gigantic bats. And the only one I think of is when Thu the Sorcerer, who is, of course, Sauron, flies off. He takes the form of a giant bat. But that's obviously not a real giant bat. That's Sauron.
Billy makes a good point. I wonder if the name Thu is going to show up in the movie. Wouldn't that be interesting? No, probably not.
You know, Billy, huge props. If they do that, if Thu or Thúrin Gwethil gets mentioned in the film, I will, like, my respect will grow enormously.
But don't you think that would, like, delighted. Lawsuit City for sure would show up then?
It's like, well, it depends.
They don't really have rights to that name.
They don't have rights to Thúrin Gwethil, that's for sure. But again, like, yeah. What would constitute fair use? I mean, just using the name, you know.
Maybe they just transpose the first letters of each name, you know, make it.
Yeah. Maybe.
Gurin yeah. Thethel.
Yeah. I wasn't even going to try.
yeah. Maybe. Yeah, now Kate Neville points out that they don't necessarily have to be giant bats if there are enough of them. The birds the birds in the Hitchcock film were no bigger than ordinary birds, and they wrought much havoc. So we could have, yes, like the bats, right? And because there certainly were enough of them to but attacking the eagles, that's the thing that I have a hard time seeing them as normal-sized bats attacking en masse and therefore having a real impact on the soldiers on the ground. I can easily see the idea of an enormous eagle soaring down through the air and being bothered by any number of tiny little bats is a little harder for me to imagine. But, you know, it's possible.
We'll see.
It's possible.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So now, you ready now?
Go for it.
Crying out loud. Okay. Now, as far as the wondering is concerned. Oh, wait, sorry. You're going to interrupt me again? What?
Oh, well, I did have just one thing I wanted to say before you started. About the rings, about the rings, about the rings, okay? Because I thought of this when you guys were talking earlier about Fellowship of the Ring. And, Corey, you and I were talking before we went live about the – I actually had brought up the thing about, you know, did they ever mention in the movie that the dwarves had rings? They did, didn't they, in the very, very beginning in that prologue that
the prologue
does.
Right? In the prologue, yes. The seven rings for the dwarves are there.
Yeah, so we have talked about that. Okay, that's all I wanted to say. So you go right ahead.
Exactly. So, okay, so the One Ring, you know, Jackson has more or less addressed how he's going to, I think that a couple of the major questions that we've had, he has indicated how they're going to go. One is, to what extent is he going to make the One Ring an obviously corruptive force in the film? Is Bilbo going to be affected by it in ways in which he's not in the books, certainly? That is in the Hobbit book. He's not. But, and Jackson has said something which seems to me entirely sensible, which is that in the films, Bilbo is going to be affected a little, you know, sort of progressively. He'll be a little bit more affected by it each time. The difficulty with this is it kind of, I mean, if that's the sort of trajectory, if over the course of these three films, you know, over the course of this 1 year, the ring is affecting him more and more and more, then like what it, we would expect him to already look like Gollum 60 years later. But anyway, whatever. I think we can ignore that. So the fact that it's going to have sort of a small and gradual impact seems to me to make sense. The other question was, how are they going to depict the experience of wearing the ring? Of course, for Frodo in the films, the experience of wearing the rings was fairly unusual, not only in the fact that he is being given this sort of psychedelic access to, you know, visual access to the spirit world, as with the encounter with the Ringwraiths on Weathertop, but also that he is exposed to Sauron and sees the eye from a distance and gets the creepy voiceover and all that. And Jackson has pretty much said that that latter is not going to happen, and the rationale is simply going to be that Sauron's not yet, you know, alert, you know, that Sauron isn't, is not, since he hasn't really returned to power yet, he's not really searching for the ring yet, and so therefore that effect isn't going to happen. Okay. Now, this still doesn't answer, for me, some very simple premises about how is it going to appear on, like, the invisibility mechanically, how are they going to do that on film? I haven't seen anything that's really answered that question for me yet, but anyway, I'm not too bothered about that. So I think the ring of the finding of the One Ring and the Ring of Power, I think, you know, they have certainly with Gollum, they have enough to work with of the audience's understanding of things from the Lord of the Rings films to just be able to foreshadow that in some fairly subtle ways and not worry too much about it. To me, the more interesting question in approaching this first film is the question of the Dwarven Rings. And this, of course, hinges back on something that we've already talked about, and which, unfortunately, my confidence has been slightly undermined by Philippa Boyens' comments about the trolls, I have to admit. But if we get the encounter with Thrain in the first film, the big deal, when Gandalf meets Thrain in the pits of Dol Guldur, he gets the key and the map from him, of course, but that's all that's mentioned in the Hobbit book. But of course, later on, when he comes back to this, the really big deal, the biggest deal of all to Thrain is that his ring has been taken from him. The last of the seven rings was owned by Thorin's family. The House of Durin still held one of the seven rings. Thror had it. He gave it to Thrain before Thror went back to Moria which was not a good idea. Neither of them turns out to be a good idea. Then Thrain takes it with him when he tries to get back to Erebor and is captured by the Necromancer, and it is thus in the pits of Dol Guldur that Sauron takes back the last of the Seven Rings, and so finally his long-standing recall order on the Seven Rings of Power is finally fulfilled. Now, in The Quest of Erebor, again, when Tolkien revisits the Hobbit story from the Lord of the Rings perspective, he really emphasizes the presence and the significance of the Dwarven Ring, especially to Thrain personally. And when Gandalf recounts, in The Quest of Erebor account, when Gandalf recounts his meeting with Thrain, what he emphasizes is that Thrain just keeps talking about the ring, the last of the seven, the last of the seven. You know, that what he is really focused on is the fact that he has lost his ring. And we should also remember, going back one step further to ring lore from that we are told in The Lord of the Rings, the significance of the Seven Rings of Power is that they are a kind of a middle ground between the Nine and the Three. The Nine Rings, of course, were designed by Sauron and made to bring the nine human wielders under his dominion, and they become the ring wraiths and his slaves. The Three Rings, of course, were not made by Sauron and were and were not controlled by him and were still usable for good, even though there are implications that that good is still kind of compromised and that they are at least vulnerable to the One Ring. The Seven are in the middle, and they also, like the Nine Rings, they were made by Sauron. So they have their roots in Sauron's evil plans to try to ensnare people. But what Tolkien says about them in The Lord of the Rings is that the Nine Rings basically failed. I mean, I just, you know, made my standard joke about Sauron's recall order, because that's what he does. The Nine Rings don't work. They don't make the dwarves into little dwarf wraiths, which is what his plan had been, but the dwarves themselves turn out to be not susceptible to wraithification. And so, so the rings don't work the way that Sauron intended. They do bring about evil. What they do is they tend to make the dwarves, they amplify the dwarves' greediness and their lust for gold. But they do also give power. And the primary power that the Dwarven Rings seem to have is somehow to help the dwarves get rich, to help them to amass treasure. I don't know quite exactly how that works, but we're told that at the heart of each of the major dwarf hordes of old, there was a ring. And so this means, therefore, that the hoard of Thror, the heap of treasure upon which Smaug is sitting, is a consequence of the Ring of Power. So the lustful desire that is inspired by the hoard in Thorin in The Hobbit is attributed to the power of the dragon. That this is the power of gold on which a dragon has long brooded. But another layer is put onto that through the Lord of the Rings, that in addition, that the very root of that hoard, the very origin of it, is in the questionable power of one of the seven Dwarven Rings of Power in the first place. So that in one sense, Smaug's coming to claim it is not so much a transformation of the hoard from something benevolent or neutral into something dangerous and sinister, is not so much a transformation than like a fulfillment of its destiny, or like an amplification of what it already was or was at risk of becoming through the influence of the Dwarven Ring of Power. So my question is basically, how much of any of this is going to be involved? The rings, of course, obviously provide one of the clearest links between the Hobbit story and the Lord of the Rings story. And the possibility of being able to involve the Dwarf Ring in some way, either as part of the backdrop to the Hobbit story or as part of the plot itself, seems to me to be, you know, certainly available for the filmmakers to kind of deal with. So how are they going to deal with that? How are they going to bring that in at all? Because here's another thing. From the wider perspective of the post Lord of the Rings era, from, you know, what I think of as the Quest of Erebor perspective, Gandalf knows what the point of the dwarf journey is. That is, he's not just trying to reestablish Erebor, he's trying to get rid of the dragon so that the dragon can't be used by Sauron as a weapon or an ally for him to try to go over the mountains and attack Rivendell or come down to attack Lorien. Gandalf's plan is to take advantage of the fact that there are these dwarves who really want to also get rid of the dragon to help them so that he can accomplish one of his ends and help to thwart some of Sauron's plans. But Sauron is not, you know, the story, the Hobbit story, is a very dwarf-centered story. And Sauron is not very dwarf-centered. That is, I think a reason needs to be given as to why Sauron particularly cares about this group of dwarves and one hobbit traveling through the Northland. They certainly don't look like much of a threat to Smaug. And of course, in the book, they don't turn out to be much of a threat to Smaug. So if we are going to have, as it seems we're going to, based on everything we've seen, I think that we're going to, it seems to me, we're going to be getting the necromancer actually paying attention to and caring about and trying to thwart, you know, the dwarves' quest. Why should he care? You know, why should he even pay attention to this? Why should it be a big deal? And again, I wonder, it's conceivable that the Dwarven Ring could be used as a kind of a link there to give Sauron and the dwarves more of a personal history, and especially Sauron and Thran's family, to give them more of a backstory, because he is the one who gave them the ring and also took the ring away from them. Does Thorin know about the ring? He doesn't in the book, of course, because the ring didn't exist in the book. But does Thorin know about the Ring of Power? Even in the Quest of Erebor, his dad hasn't really told him about it. That he doesn't really know, you know, he doesn't get it. Thran doesn't give it to him before Thran sets off on his journey. So Thorin is still not necessarily totally in the dark, but he's not involved with it. Are they going to play up that angle? Is Thorin going to be looking for the ring of his father's? Is he concerned about that? Is that going to be on his radar screen at all? It could be. Remember that in the Lord of the Rings, when Balin goes to invade Moria and to try to reoccupy Moria, his primary motivation was to search for the Ring of Power. They thought that Thror took it with him when Thror went to Moria and was killed by Azog. And so therefore, they conclude, the Ring of Power, the last Ring of Power, is probably in Moria somewhere where Azog had it, because they, the dwarves who defeated Azog and the goblins, never sacked Moria. They never went into it, as some of them wanted to do when they won the battle. But they never went, so the ring might just be lying in there, never reclaimed, and now taken over by goblins again. So Balin is... So this idea of, like, the lingering influence of... Not influence, direct influence of the Dwarven Ring, but this sort of life that it has as a motivator of dwarvish actions and as a potential connection between Sauron and the dwarves does carry on for a while in the further story as Tolkien develops it in both the Quest of Erebor and in the Lord of the Rings itself. So that then sets up my overall question as to, is this going to be done at all in the films? Any thoughts or reflections on any of this stuff before I ask the question in official riddling form?
We've got a lot of comments.
See, Daniel's
like,
not sure about this.
Daniel Helen says,
if Thorin wanted the ring, surely he would ask Gandalf if he knew anything about it, or would Thorin think his grandfather had the ring last? Possibly. At least that's certainly what the rest of the, that's what Dan and Balin and the rest of the survivors believe in the Lord of the Rings, that it was Thror who had it. Would Thorin mention it to ask Gandalf? I don't think he would ask Gandalf. I think he would play that one really close to the vest. Because, you know, dwarves are suspicious and secretive under the best of circumstances, and when it comes to things like the Ring of Power, even remember the little preface that Glowin gives when he finally comes out with that at the Council of Elrond. You know, he says, "Indeed, I may now reveal, you know, that it was, you know, chiefly to seek for the Ring of Thror that Balin went to Moria." He didn't lead with that. You know, he doesn't say that at the beginning. He grudgingly reveals that they were looking for the ring. They don't want to talk about it.
So, yeah, but maybe the dwarves don't actually want people to know they're looking for it.
Yeah, or even to know that it exists. So I wouldn't expect Thorin to talk to Gandalf about it, but might we hear him refer to it? Might we hear some, you know, dwarf-on-dwarf conversation? I don't know if Thorin is going to have a confidant among the other dwarves. I would guess he might. Balin would seem to be the leading candidate for that role, as like Thorin's senior advisor. Among the dwarves, are we going to get some Thorin Balin conversation or references to the ring? You know, that certainly could be possible. Andrew has an interesting point. You know, he asks, will the scene of the shards of Narsil and Rivendell open up this question? You know, that is the idea of with the Ring of Power and that coming up conceivably. We're going to get it, of course. We're going to have the rings involved. I mean, if you think about it, actually, all of the rings of power are going to be involved here. We'll get the ring wraiths, right, in the tombs of the Nazgul. So I imagine the nine rings are going to come up. We will probably, I would think, see the three elven rings in action in some sense in the Battle of Dol Guldur. We have, of course, the Ring of Power that Bilbo already has secretly. So the Dwarven Rings are the only one missing the party here, and although they certainly, we're not going to, obviously we wouldn't see them acting in concert because they're mostly gone, but would this kind of put it on the film's, you know, would this whole situation put that on the radar screen of the films?
Well, and so...
So you're thinking that there would at least be a mention of them, right? Like a nod.
Dave, what were you going to say?
Well, one question that this raises for me is, and of course, I'm going to add the caveat that there's no requirement that their interpretation of the Hobbit on screen be consistent with events from the Lord of the Rings books that were not portrayed on screen in their film version of those. You know, the one thing that I would wonder about is any effort to emphasize the dwarf ring on screen in these films. Sort of, it seems like it would lead inevitably to it being a topic of conversation amongst characters, something that people are aware of. And that, I mean, like, one thing I always wondered about in reading through all these books was the fact that the dwarves did not know what happened to Thror's ring, but Gandalf did, and you always felt like, you know, Gandalf, that would have been good to know, buddy. Like,
right. It's kind of a jerk move by Gandalf not to just mention that.
Exactly. Glowin's like, yeah, that's actually, you know, we're here because our good friend Balin, you remember him, right, Gandalf? Yeah, he led a bunch of dwarves away on an ill-advised quest to retake Moria, all to find the ring. He's not going to find it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Probably should have mentioned before that I've known for centuries.
Could have saved a lot of trouble and grief and suffering if I'd just...
I had it written on a piece of paper that I had in my pocket for 91 years.
Yeah, right, exactly. I've known this for 100 years. I just never thought it was important to mention until this very moment. So anyway, if they do try to play up the ring, it seems like they can't really go that route of Gandalf not... You know, it seems like Gandalf won't know what happened to it in this film, or he'll reveal it, which would be, you know, which would make the diehard Tolkien fans howl, maybe, because it's inconsistent with the books. And they don't have to be consistent with the books, but it's just one thing I wonder, like, if they're going to play it up, it'll have to be... They'll have to change that. People will have to know what's happened to it, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I also sort of wonder, how are they going to get any closure to that? Because, you know, I mean, goodness, you could even, one could even imagine the dwarf ring, one could go so far as to actually involve it in the story itself. I mean, if we were debating, in fact, on our very first Riddles in the Dark episode ever, whether or not we're actually going to meet Thran himself.
Yes.
And, you know, if that's the case, the seizure of his ring and the question of what happened to his ring could very well happen on screen. I mean, we could get, because, you know, a question that I would have is, you know, what kind of, if they're searching for it, one difficulty is that, or if they're thinking about it even, or talking about it, how do you give closure to that particular plot line?
Right.
Of the films. Do they just, is it by discovering at the end, do we have, as you were suggesting, Gandalf coming to them in book three and or in film three and saying, yeah, guys, actually, I've just been to Dol Guldur and Sauron totally has the ring. Sorry about that. You know.
So what? Don't go questing after it.
Whatever you do, yeah, don't try to set up an ill-advised Moria colony in order to find it, because it's totally not worth your time. So yeah, I mean that's one possibility, and I mean it could be you know, Sharon brings up a really interesting point, which is how are they going to sort of, are they going to involve the Arkenstone? We have assiduously avoided talking about the Arkenstone in this show because nothing could have been clearer than the fact that the Arkenstone is a originally film two, now film three issue. And I still certainly believe that that's true. But of course, the Arkenstone in the book is the thing of central desire. And it's one of the things which would be complicated by involving the Dwarven Ring. If the Dwarven Ring becomes the greatest treasure of Thorin's house, which it is, then it displaces the Arkenstone. The Arkenstone becomes the second greatest treasure of Thorin's house.
Right.
And therefore, its role at the end of the story becomes made more awkward or kind of reduced. So by not having the Dwarf Ring involved, you at least kind of maintain the integrity of that plot.
Yeah, that's somebody brought this up a long time ago in the comments on the Mythgard site, proposed the idea that maybe they'll conflate Dwarf Ring and Arkenstone will become like the nickname for the ring.
Right.
Because you're right, that is there is kind of a dilemma here in that that as you say, if the ring is emphasized, then the role of the Arkenstone naturally has to be de-emphasized. Unless mm-hmm. they cleared up from the very beginning, Thorin's like, I'd really like to get that ring back, and Gandalf's like, well, you won't find it, the Necromancer took it. All right, well,
right.
Okay, well, I guess I'll settle for an Arkenstone then.
right.
But at the same time, the Arkenstone it kind of is this weird artifact. Hey, we're getting into the Verlin Flieger's talk from MythCon in 2011.
From MythCon last year.
But it's a weird artifact in that she argues that it's used effectively in the story, which I think was a good argument. But in the overall mythology. It's kind of this weird sort of one-off thing that doesn't really sort of fit well into the rest of the bigger picture of the Lord of the Rings and all of that. The ring kind of fits better into that storyline. So
yes, and you'll notice how basically the Arkenstone gets retired at mm-hmm. the end of The Hobbit, and because it's placed on Thorin's breast, right? I mean, it's basically laid on his tomb, and therefore, and like that's kind of the end of the Arkenstone story. Now the idea of the conflation is an interesting one, and like lest people be like overly shocked and appalled by that. Not that there's nothing shocking and appalling about it, but actually, there is some resonance with that in Tolkien's earlier thought on it. If you look at the earliest plot notes, the earliest sketch that Tolkien ever wrote about how the Hobbit story would end, as he was writing the Hobbit, as he was writing out the manuscript, he would stop every once in a while and write just like a page of sketchy notes, which would sometimes get a little bit more full, and he'd include some dialogue and stuff as ideas came to him. But he would sketch out these ideas for how the next part of the story was going to go. And in the very first set of plot notes, which he writes right about the time of the end of the first film, actually, when Bilbo and the wizard and dwarves all arrive at Beorn's house, at that point he sketches out through the end of the story. And Bilbo was going to get the Arkenstone. It wasn't called that yet. It was called the Gem of Girion. But it was designed initially to be a portable 14th share for Bilbo. Since Bilbo obviously couldn't take 1/14th of the entire treasure home, and the dwarves didn't want to cheat him, they were gonna give him this incredibly fabulous gem, which did not yet have the kind of family significance that it comes to have for Thorin. But instead, they were going to give it to Bilbo. And there's this really fascinating reference that Bilbo was going to take the Gem of Girion home, and he was going to get, like, obsessed with it. It wasn't going to be his ring, that was going to corrupt him later in life. It was the Arkenstone that he was going to take it home, and he was going to keep it in a safe, but every day he was going to go and take it out and look at it. And, I mean, there are these, like, kind of implications that the Arkenstone has a sketchy effect on Bilbo. Like the ring, in fact, goes on to have its effect on Bilbo. So this idea of the Arkenstone as an object of desire, which is perhaps not just a passive object of desire, but certainly becomes something that people begin to have a Gollum-esque relationship with, is something that he was contemplating. You know, he briefly contemplated for Bilbo as he was drafting The Hobbit, and later on, of course, becomes much more firmly associated with Thorin as his desire to possess the Arkenstone becomes more and more possessive, leading him even to threaten violence and death against his own companions if they withhold it from him, which, of course, to be fair, one of them is. So anyway, the concept that the ring, the ring of power, and the Arkenstone could have a similar kind of effect, as, you know, and could be in that sense kind of conflatable, is one which, you know, is not, I think, entirely alien to the way that Tolkien described it, especially since the Arkenstone is clearly a lot like the Silmarils, both in its description and in its effect on people, especially Thorin, and also Bilbo to a lesser extent. And the Silmarils, of course, are themselves like the precursor of the Rings of Power. So, connecting those two things is not totally crazy. And I could imagine a conflation. It would be a little bit weird if instead of a gem, you know, a large and heavy gem, they were fighting over a ring with a gem in it or something like that, you know, and so that would feel kind of awkward to me, but it doesn't sound insane, I have to say.
Yeah, I agree with that, although at the end of the day, I think that my general feeling is that, one, for on-screen sort of effects, a giant Arkenstone kind of works a little bit better. And then for narrative simplicity, having Bilbo fumbling around with two rings seems confusing and complicated.
Yes.
And I think I personally think, and also I think the ring storyline would confuse things even more. It's like, wait, why are we going on this quest again? Is it to reclaim their homeland, as is mentioned in the trailer? Is it to get the treasure? Is it get the Arkenstone? Is it get the ring? I think just sort of on balance, I'm leaning in the direction of no ring, or minimal ring.
Minimal ring. Which brings us to the riddle. So the question is, what role will the Dwarven Ring of Power play in the film? And option A is none at all. It will not even be alluded to. That is the book answer, because it is indeed not alluded to at all in the book, at least not in the original Hobbit book. So no reference to the ring whatsoever is A. B is there will be a reference to it. We will be made aware of its existence. We will know that Thran had a ring, but it's not going to be a feature. You know, it's going to be something that's going to be alluded to and dropped, not going to be any part of the story. Option C is... Wait, Trish, what was option C again? I'm forgetting option C.
Something about foreshadowing the power of the One Ring?
Oh, yes. It will be...
It only foreshadows.
Right. It will be invoked, but only as a foreshadowing of the effect of the One Ring. We will hear about... and this, I think, it really hinges upon whether we get Thran or the story of Thran in the first film. If we don't, this is going to end up being a second film question. And I would actually suggest that maybe if we don't end up getting Gandalf and Dol Guldur in film one, that we might have to just bump this question and our predictions back to the second film.
But we'll just replay this part of the episode today as a new episode.
Exactly. but anyway, so that basically it serves it's invoked, but only as a foreshadowing of the corruptive influence of the One Ring. Like that is, it's just a setup. It's just a setup for Bilbo's ring, to kind of help us to understand the significance of Bilbo's ring, to see in Thran, to either hear about or see in Thran the corruptive influence of the possession. Because, of course, what Bilbo is going to have, he's not going to understand what he has. He will have met Gollum, but I am not sure how clear it's going to be. It is certainly not clear to Bilbo in the book, even in the revised version of the book, the post-1947 version of the book, where Gollum is corrupted by the ring and more wicked and miserable. Even there, it is not. Bilbo doesn't have any suspicion that the ring did that to him. Right, that possession of the ring is what makes you into that. So I could imagine, for instance, the film using the story of Thran and his desperation and what led him to do what he did, and his, because he is, in the Quest of Erebor, he has some definite Gollum moments. You know, when Gandalf meets him, the reason he's witless, like what has driven him insane, is the taking away of his ring, that he has had his ring taken away by force, and it's all he can talk about. And he is pretty incoherent about everything else, which is why Gandalf doesn't know who the map and key belong to, doesn't even know for sure at the time who it is that he's speaking to. He doesn't even know that it's Thran. So again, that could be, again, used as a foreshadowing of the effect of a ring of power upon the holder of it. And then option D would be that it is more, in some of the ways, in one or more of the ways that I was describing, actually integrated into the plot and made to be, either it appears or, either it appears, becomes one of, Thorin's goals in the quest, or becomes something which informs the backstory of Sauron and Thorin's house, and so therefore influences the necromancer plot. Some kind of active, and I'm being deliberately vague about this, because I think that any way in which it actually impacts the development of the story, becomes a feature of the narrative, would for me count as D.
Mm-hmm.
So Dave, are you an A or a B? Are you a no reference at all, or passing reference and that's it?
Boy, oh boy, this is a tough one. I'm going with A.
Going with A?
No mention.
Totally silent on the ring question.
Yep.
Hoping that we're going to forget the fact that dwarves were handed rings of power in the prologue of the Fellowship of the Ring.
Not that we'll forget, but just that it doesn't concern this storyline.
Right, right. That it's irrelevant to the storyline. Yeah. Trish, what do you think?
I'm going with B, which is what you were leading Dave to do. Well, because I think Jackson is going to remain conscious of making, his continuity between the two, two trilogies. So I think there will be a past reference, but I don't think it's going to, I think that'll be it. I don't think it's going to foreshadow, and I don't think it's going to be a plot feature. How about you, Corey?
I think it's going to foreshadow. I'm going with C. I do think in the end it's going to complicate things too much. I could imagine it happening, but I think in the end it's going to complicate things too much, Dave, as you were suggesting. Like, certainly having multiple rings, in particular Bilbo in possession of multiple rings, would be very confusing. Like, which ring do I have in which pocket? But that's not going to work. But if we get Thran, I think Thran is going to be a proto-Gollum. I do. I think that that's going to be, it provides them with the opportunity for a middle ground. That is, in Bilbo and Gollum, we get a before and after picture of the corruptive power of the ring. In Thran, we get a more kind of halfway stage, and something that is more recognizable. Gollum, one of the whole dramas of the Gollum plot of The Lord of the Rings is Frodo's recognition of Gollum as a ruined creature, as somebody who is like him, but who has been ruined. That, of course, is the insight that Bilbo has, which leads him to have pity on Gollum in the Hobbit book. And I will be very interested to see how that gets played. And if Martin Freeman is going to have his moment of pity, and how that's going to be handled, because it's a whole internal in the book. So Anyway, I'll be very interested to see that. But anyway, as I say, that idea, but the point is that it's a revelation. When you look at Gollum, the first thought is not necessarily, oh, he's a guy who used to be just like you and me, but who has been over centuries twisted and corrupted by the power of the ring. He's too far gone for that. Thrain is not too far gone, and he provides a middle ground to enable them to show the stages. Bilbo might not look at Gollum and say, oh, like, if I keep this ring that I have in my pocket right now, it's going to turn me into that. The audience might not necessarily think that directly, though, I mean, they know about this more having seen the Lord of the Rings films. But if we can get through Thrain that kind of warning, that kind of like, here's somebody who doesn't look like a hobbit exactly, but at least looks recognizable, somebody who looks like Thorin or somebody who looks like one of the other dwarves, and we see what his ring of power did to him. And to have that as a kind of a warning, even if it's kind of subtle, to sort of set up this progression that Peter Jackson is pointing to, that we're going to see in Bilbo, of the ring influencing him more and more, and to have Thrain as an opportunity to set that up. Especially if the initial speculations about the trailer from last December are correct, and Thrain is that crazy guy that Gandalf is finding right in the ruins,
mm-hmm.
Then I feel even more... I've still never been 100% sold that that's, in fact, what that is. But if it is, then I would feel even more confident in my prediction that we're going to get Thrain not just as kind of witless and wandering as he is described, but completely crazy.
Proto-Gollum Thrain?
Yes, Proto-Gollum.
Do you think that could also be one of the action figures that they'll release? Proto-Gollum Thrain?
Proto-Gollum Thrain, yes. Barking Mad Thrain the Dwarf.
Yes. I want them to actually officially name the character Proto-Gollum Thrain.
Proto-Gollum Thrain.
And maybe that's an indicator that Thrain won't show up until the film too, because we don't have the toy out yet.
Well, there are lots of toys we don't have yet.
Actually, this is true. That brings up a good clarifying question, which is that in keeping with our policy, we are referring to the first film. So
that's right.
So if it happens to be the case that the ring is not mentioned at all in the first film and then becomes like the most important central artifact of the second film, I still got it right.
That's right.
Maybe.
You notice, Corey, that Dave is more concerned now about him being right.
I know.
No. It's less that and more about making sure we're clear on the rules of the game so that we can determine a winner. So that there's no oh well, it got pushed off to the second film, but it was still there, so technically I was kinda right. No. First film.
Okay. Here's the one thing I'll say. I will be lobbying our adjudicating committee. If Gandalf's trip to Dol Guldur is in fact pushed back to the second film, I am going to lobby to push this prediction question back to the second film. Because I think that it basically, to say that it's not mentioned just because it hasn't been mentioned yet, because to me that changes the parameters of this question. So if we don't get Dol Guldur at all in this, if that in fact is going to be happening while they're up in Mirkwood, and so we don't even get the opportunity to meet Proto Gollum Thrain, I'm not going to be able to determine this, because I won't be able to determine this unilaterally, but I would petition the committee to push this back and make it a second film.
In general, my feeling is that for topics like this, where if there is a reason to, particularly if it's a sort of, you know, turns out it wasn't included in this film, but if there's a very good reason to revisit it and say we are led to believe that it will be featured in a later film, I think it would be perfectly appropriate to do the question again. I'm just saying, it's not so much pushing this question back as it is just doing another question or revisiting the question again. But
well, that's fair.
But all along, our policy in general has been, unless in order to enable ourselves to be able to, after the first film comes out, to sit down and actually go through the questions and determine quote unquote correct answers and actually be able to give out prizes and assign winners and whatnot. In order to be able to do that, that's why we generally have the policy of questions as the questions posed before this film apply to the first film. If we're led to believe that somehow the question actually remains relevant for later films, okay, we'll ask it again, but we'll still score the question this time around for the first film. So,
are you okay with that, Corey?
I suppose so. Though, as I say, I would feel cheated if the Gandalf and Dol Guldur, which we have been led to believe, because really this is a post split into three films issue. I mean, that first trailer does pretty strongly suggest that Gandalf is going to be doing some of this solo quest.
But you're right; it's not clear. I mean, because recall in the Empire magazine, they did say Gandalf at Dol Guldur moved to film two.
Right, but is it the Battle of Dol Guldur?
No. Well, the context of the quote. Let me pull it up. Dang it! Where is this frickin' link? Empire magazine. Ah, there we go. And it's on page 6. So go back to there. We go. On page 6, they say they were 2 weeks away from Comic-Con 2012, where Jackson would reveal footage from Bag End, Gollum's Cave, and an intervening montage that turned out to be more forward-looking than he might have had in mind. Evangeline Lilly's Elf Maiden and Gandalf being stalked through the overcast ruins of Dol Guldur is now in Episode 2, The Desolation of Smaug.
Oh, jeez.
And Jackson says, falls up, we were looking at some of the cutting that we'd done, thinking about the overall shape of two films and how to shape blah, 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 blah. Basically, and again, I add the caveat here that the comments about Evangeline Lilly and Gandalf here are not in quotes, so this could be confirmed or this could be extrapolation by the author. But the indication, according to the author, is that scenes that we've previously seen in released material, trailers, Comic-Con, whatever, that at the time we were meant to see because it was planned to be in film one, is now being moved to film two, and Peter Jackson's makes it, the indication is that it's making him a little uncomfortable because it's like, we showed you this and oops, actually now we've moved it to film two.
But I'm going to be about the writer the way you are about the actors. I mean, if this guy or girl who wrote the article has not read the book, mm-hmm. and Jackson says something or Boyan says something about Dol Guldur is going to get moved to film two, mm-hmm. they could just have inferred this.
Yeah,
it's because possible. They don't know that's how Gandalf gets the map and ring.
No, it's possible, but what they're referring to, what they're referring directly to, is not just the general idea or story of Gandalf going to Dol Guldur, but specifically scenes that we saw that we are in this conversation referring to. So we're saying we've seen this scene of Gandalf at Dol Guldur fighting crazy old Thran. And what the article is indicating is, you know, that scene of Gandalf at Dol Guldur fighting old Thran, that's in film two now.
Right. But again, I still think that could be an inference, but anyway.
Well, the main reason I'm bringing...
Then it opens the question as to how Gandalf gets the map and key.
Well, the main reason I'm bringing this up is basically this is all to say, you were warned. You have no right. You have no right to complain and say they showed us that scene, but it wasn't in the first film. No. You've been warned.
You're right about that.
Probably not in the first film. So
you're right about that. Okay, that's fair. That's fair. And I have to admit that my mind is simply shuddering back in blankness from the idea of Toriel accompanying Gandalf.
I don't think that's meant to.
Is that what it's suggesting?
I think it's actually talking about two things.
Scenes. Yes. About Toriel, comma, and Gandalf stalking. So not Toriel and Gandalf stalking in Dol Guldur.
Yes, because
so
I don't
watch your punctuation.
I don't recall ever seeing footage or being or anyone Whew. Mentioning
no.
footage
no.
or describing footage no. of the two of them together. I hope.
No. no.
Yes,
okay.
Corey. Whew. The first time I read that, I was also like, what? No.
Yes.
Didn't even register this is being pushed to film too. I just got hung up on, hey, Toriel and Gandalf at Dol Guldur. Oh my God. And I was like, no, wait. I think it's two separate things.
Okay. Okay. Excellent. All right.
All right.
Delvin.
So
just
I'm
my
sticking
final
with
plea,
C.
my final plea is
Okay.
this. I would strongly recommend that everybody listening, when making predictions to this, base it upon when you're thinking, the question is, as is our policy, will the dwarf ring play a role in particular in the first film? And in deciding how it might play a role, I strongly suggest people not assume that footage of Gandalf at Dol Guldur will be included in the first film. It that's shaky
Okay.
ground. I would think more that's likely to be put in the second film. So if the ring's going to be included in the first film, how might it be included? Will it be brought up at the dinner at Bag End or some other, a White Council scene or something? And that's largely why I'm going with it. I'm leaning toward the direction of very little presence of the ring, because I don't think there's a very good way to introduce it that won't confuse the story. So.
Okay. Well, I still think that at least an exposition of... the map and the key have to come from somewhere.
Yes, exactly.
So there's got to be something. And it may well be that footage of Gandalf and Dol Guldur that we saw before, which we all believed at the time was probably Gandalf's trip where he gets the map and key and meets Thrain, may not be. That may be involved in the Battle of Dol Guldur sequence. Somehow, which I don't know how that's going to play itself out, especially since.
Or the other possibility is that Gandalf. The other possibility is that Gandalf talks about having gotten the map and key from Thrain in movie one, but the scene of Dol Guldur is a flashback in movie two. You know, remember how they did the Sméagol story with the ring?
Right. Right.
That could happen
right.
too. So
possibly. Though I wouldn't think that they would use that as a flashback in that way.
No, I wouldn't either, but it's possible.
But anyway, yeah, it is because, unless, of course, my theory would be entirely blown out of the water if they just decide that Gandalf is getting the map and key some other way. though I don't know where exactly. But anyway, whatever. I'm sticking with
a whole other episode on that.
I'm sticking with C. And that is my rationale.
And I'm glad,
now,
based on the map and key.
And I'm glad. I think it's really fun when each person gives a different answer, then we actually are getting some controversy.
That almost never happens, actually.
Well, controversy.
Yes.
I don't think that's. I think this is like the first time, isn't it?
Not the first, but certainly one of the most controversial. Should we review answers from
which is amazing to me, given how much difficulty we had coming up with this riddle question. So I'm pleased that
That's
we
true.
Have controversy.
So, listeners, those of you who are listening with us live here, we've got a couple votes. Jason votes B, and
Andrew
Evan
Higgins
votes,
yay, Jason.
Votes C.
D.
Okay.
Braze with me, B. Yeah.
All right.
Ed and Billy are A's. We did have a C. We did have a C back here somewhere.
Yep.
Billy C.
Owen.
A.
Owen did C.
So, Kate, a reminder. A is no reference to the ring at all. B is passing reference to the ring, but no involvement in the story of any significance at all. C is it's involved, but only as a kind of foreshadowing or building up to the Ring of Power and its influence on Bilbo. You know, that is only as a like case study in Ring of Power ownership and its risks. D, is that it has some kind of more significant role in the plot, that it's actually, it becomes a plot feature in some larger sense.
E is, it's a talking character like the purse.
Well, and I was going to add, just in case it makes a difference, A is the Dave answer, B is the Trish answer, and C is the Corey answer.
That's right. All right, I'm getting some C's. Some are several other people following me on the primrose path here.
Dave, do you notice that when he gives the answers are A is really short, B is really short, C he explains in great detail.
Hey,
well,
Billy is excited to be in agreement with me and Mark Fisher.
Yeah,
Mark
right.
Fisher.
That's right.
Who will just, I guess we're just presupposing he'll select A.
Yeah.
Kelly. Kelly prefers A or B, but she's imagining some horrible combination of D and E.
Yes. Yes. If anybody actually has like a dialogue with the Dwarven Ring of Power, that's E. Yeah, that counts as E. Yeah, like a Turin Turinbar-esque conversation.
Yeah, if it whispers like the ring in Lord of the Rings did, that doesn't count, right?
Ooh. I wouldn't do that. But yeah, no, that would be
so.
No, I don't know. That would be the unofficial E. But
anyway, Ed says option P, Philippa just makes up some crazy thing.
Now that's not fair. yeah. Okay. All right. Very good.
Now, and, Corey, you might want to bring people up. If I was going to say, if people enjoy this kind of conversation, you have a venue.
Exactly. No, I was just going to talk about that. Okay. So yes, we have been moving forward. We've announced this in previous times, but we have now arrangements have been made and ticket sales are open. We have now officially MythMoot 2012, sponsored by the Mythgard Institute. It will be a gathering of Mythgard students and Tolkien fans to watch the Hobbit film together. We have an official venue. We are meeting at the Cinemark Egyptian 24 in Hanover, Maryland. We have a theater reserved there, where we will be watching the film in 3D in 48 frames per second. So we will get the full Peter Jackson Hobbit effect here. So we have a private screening of this film. After this, we are going to be retiring to the BWI Marriott, where we have some conference space reserved, and we are going to spend the rest of that day and part of the next talking over the film, because we're going to have a lot of conversation that we're going to have a lot of ground to go over. A lot of us will, I know, want to be sharing our reactions and talking things over. So we are making this into sort of a mini little academic conference. It's not going to be an academic conference in the sense of people writing papers and coming to read papers and stuff. It's going to be more open discussion panels, because it's going to be primarily about the Hobbit film that we will just have seen together. So we're going to spend the afternoon on Saturday at the hotel, talking over the film, and we're going to have some, you know, breakout sessions and smaller discussion groups to address sort of particular angles of the film, and then we'll come back together and do presentations from those groups on Sunday so that we can all talk about them together. We're going to have a banquet there at the Marriott on Saturday night to celebrate the release of the film that we've been looking forward to so much through these podcast episodes. So this is going to be sort of the ultimate Riddles in the Dark experience. We're going to have announcements of winners. We're going to have the scoring. People who are there attending the panel are going to be serving as our official adjudicating committee, who are going to be empowered to make the decisions as to what the official correct answers are to our questions. We're going to be tallying up scores and announcing grand winners, giving various prizes. So it's gonna be really cool. We're watching the film fairly early in the day. We're gonna start the film at 10 a.m. In Hanover, because we want to make sure then we have the whole afternoon and evening to talk about things. If we started it middle afternoon, we would barely have any time left to talk. Brianna asks if any of this will be streamed live. I hope so. We're certainly going to record some of our sessions so that people, because I know not everybody's able to make it to Baltimore, Maryland, so you know, we don't want to exclude everybody who can't happen to travel. So we will do some releases of that. But this is going to be a lot of fun. We're going to have, as I say, you know, very active discussion panels. We're going to have entertainment. We're going to have a banquet. It's going to be really cool. So, those of you who live in the area, and can make it, we would love to see you. You can go to the Mythgard website, www.mythgard.org, mythgard.org, and you can find links to the MythMoot there.
It's under news and events, by the way, if somebody's looking for that. News and events.
That's right. So yeah, and you can also see we have a Facebook event. If you search on Facebook, you can also find more information there, including, you know, maps and addresses and things. so you can actually try to gauge how far away it is from where you are. We have people traveling all over the place to come to this. We have several people. We have at least two and possibly three people flying over from England, one person flying over from France, one person flying out from Alaska to come to this event. It should be a lot of fun. We'll have Trish flying up from Texas, and we hope Dave flying out from California if he can, though I know you got a lot of things going on then, so that
I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm cautiously optimistic that I'll make it.
I hope we'll be able to see. Good.
If not, we'll have to have you there as a talking head at least.
But I can't. Exactly. But I'm not purchasing my ticket ahead of time because basically what it boils down. It really comes down to I have a publication deadline. Basically that the 14th, which is the Friday, and if the paper's done 2 weeks in advance, my advisor's like, all right, well, let's just submit it ahead of time. It's nice to be done early and great. But if what's likely to happen based on past experiences, if we're working on it up until the deadline, and I'm like, by the way, advisor, we'll have to work on this remotely because I'll be on the East Coast so I can watch The Hobbit with my friends. She'll kill me. So.
I guess from a purely academic standpoint, I can understand that point of view. But
actually,
you can't say it was a previous made commitment, huh? You can't say that.
I'm committed to attend an academic conference that weekend.
Yeah.
No. Right.
Actually, so I have to look. Oh, see, the deadline is December 15th. So actually, if it had been the 14th, that would be wonderful because then I could just submit it and then catch a red eye out in time to make it to the film. But because it's
you could program your brain to think it's the 14th, couldn't you?
Well, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to make a Herculean effort over the next month to just get it done and have it be at the point
Good
where she
you.
Doesn't want to fiddle with it anymore because she has to work with the other students and their papers. And she's fine with submitting it early, and I can tell her, like, oh, I wanted to get it done for my final exams, yada, yada, yada. And then she just won't want to see me that weekend.
There you go. I think that's the best plan. I think that's the best plan. Well, anyway, so we do hope that lots of people can join us. I am really looking forward to this event. We do have limited seats available. We don't have an infinitely large space at the Marriott for our conference and banquet. And the seats have been going fairly quickly, actually. We still have a bunch left over. We're not yet in sort of crisis mode about that, but there are definitely not an infinite number of seats, and they are moving. So we would love to see you and have much sympathy for those of you who are too far away to come to this one. And we hope to, as I say, be able to get at least some recordings, if not some live discussion out to you guys there as well. So, thanks very much, everybody, for joining us today. This has been a long, rambling, and fun episode. We look forward to meeting together in another couple weeks as we continue to get closer and closer. We're now only a month and a half away here. We only have, maybe two episodes left before the release of the film?
Yeah, I think so.
That's right.
We're going to need to do a little powwow and make sure that we've asked all the questions we want, and we might have to either do some multi-question episodes or do some extra episodes or even just have some questions that we don't even get to discuss on the air, but we pose them anyway, so...
Yeah, and actually, anyone who is listening who has a suggestion for a riddle or conundrum that you think we should address or that you would like to see everyone's opinion on before the first film, do send those along. We would be very interested to hear those, to see what your suggestions are about that. And thanks to everybody who joined us today. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, I think that this was a record number of live attendees that we had today.
Definitely past 30 at one point.
Yeah, no, we had over 30 people with us here, so that was a lot of fun.
What's really interesting is the attendee list had dropped to around 25 and has since gone back up.
That's right. Yeah, I don't know who came and said, or actually probably just very experienced people who are like, well, the Riddles in the Dark episode started 2 hours ago. Well, it's not too late. I'll go in and check on that. only people who know us pretty well would make that conclusion.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, Kate and Kat, exactly. I think that most people are housebound from the hurricane here. So a lot of people on the East, everybody on the East Coast who still has power has not much else to do today because many of the roads are still closed and most businesses are still closed. So. Yep, very good. Very good. Okay, so I think that's all. So I will say thanks for listening and Godspeed.